This is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show. So thank you, Mae, for that kind introduction. I thought I'd start by telling you a bit about my story. In the neonatal world, I began my first rotation in my first week as a registrar, and I was working in a tertiary neonatal intensive care unit, and I'd previously seen one intubated baby. I was on a long shift on my second day, and my colleague, who was the only other doctor in the unit, was also on her second day as a registrar. And I remember the team leader coming to us that night. She came running over. I didn't know where my colleague was. And she said, "Your friend, she's in birth suite. There's a baby about to be born through meconium lycor, and she doesn't even know how to intubate it." And at that time, it was pretty commonplace to intubate and suction babies born through meconium lycor. And I remember staring back at her blankly, thinking, crap. I don't know how to intubate either. Like, I've seen one intubated baby. I don't even know how that ventilator works. So luckily that baby was born well that day and didn't need any further intervention from us. But I remember that terror, that fear of being in a new environment, in a completely new department, with a new set of nursing staff, some who'd been working there since before I was born and some who were just starting out like me. And I had no idea who was who. Those feelings of discomfort and stress are really common in the neonatal intensive care. Researchers have shown that up to 80% of us as junior doctors find it a distressing place to work. So luckily for me, my journey didn't stop there, and I've gone on to become a senior registrar. But really, my second chapter, the neonates, was about a year ago, just before the week before last year's conference, when I delivered 31-week twins. So this is one of them here. And it was just as terrifying as that first week, probably more so, because those babies being wheeled off down the corridor were mine. They were my babies. And my partner, dutifully followed behind them. And I remember laying there and thinking, it's okay, there'll be a few bumps in the road, but they're big babies, they're almost 1.9 kilos. I got steroids, they need minimal respiratory support at the moment, only requiring CPAP. I knew that they were likely to have similar outcomes to a term baby. And so I was there, playing this dual role of just being really terrified, but trying to switch on that rational part of my brain and just trying to work through the numbers and just, being rational. The next morning I went to visit my son, and I sat down next to him, and one of my good friends and colleagues had been the doctor in charge overnight. And when she sat down next to me and I saw her face, I knew something was wrong. She told me that my daughter needed to be intubated. And the first thing I thought when she told me that was, how could I have not gone and sat with her first? How could I have not known that she was more unwell than my son? It didn't matter that, I hadn't received a phone call and been updated about it. I felt so incredibly guilty that as her mother, I didn't sense that. So I went in and saw Edith, and I agreed, if I had been her doctor, I would intubate her. I'd seen many babies like her and intubated babies like her. She had increasing oxygen requirement, was working hard. And my mum and partner were there at the time, and I tried to reassure them. I said, she'll be okay. She probably won't be intubated for long. She's really unlikely to develop chronic neonatal lung disease. But it is one of the most terrifying moments in my whole life when she was getting intubated. So there I was, sitting there every day beside my babies, and there were a few bumps in the road for us. My son went back and forth between intensive care and special care, on and off CPAP. They remained in incubators for longer than I would have liked. They were on continuous feeds longer than I would have liked. All I wanted to be able to do was to hold them, to be able to feed them, and to be able to get out of there. And Today we're going to talk a little bit about why the neonatal intensive care unit is such a challenging place for both parents and for doctors, and what we can do to make it a better journey for ourselves and also the babies and their families. So the evidence is clear. Up to 15% of parents will leave our units feeling symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And up to 80% of us will feel burnt out and traumatised after our rotation. So if we know these rates are so high, why aren't we doing more about it? Well, there are many challenges that we face, and some of these I'm going to go through now. So for parents, the overwhelming theme in the literature is that parents feel that loss of parental role. They can't establish that relationship with their baby. There are many physical and emotional barriers that we have in the neonatal intensive care unit. Normally when you have a baby, it's passed to you. You're like, oh, okay, yep. And you know, sometimes 6 hours later, a couple of days later, you're off home with your baby, figuring everything out on your own, making all the decisions for your baby. But that doesn't occur in the intensive care. There, the treating team, guiding what's going to happen with your baby. So there's this loss of autonomy. There's this altered power dynamic between the parents and the treating team. You know, families feel shocked and disbelieved when they get admitted to the nursery, even if they've had a complicated pregnancy, even if they know that they may end up there, it's still confronting. Lots of parents have and families have limited medical knowledge. They don't know what that beeping is. They don't know why their baby needs that tube in or why they can't hold their baby. And it's an unfamiliar environment to them. Let's face it, most intensive care units smell funny. They're bright, they're noisy for 24 hours a day, and they can be displaced from that family's support unit by hundreds of kilometres. It's also challenging working there as a junior doctor. So, you know, most of us lack experience when we turn up for our first rotation. I was on my second day. That was my first ever rotation, you know, as a registrar. And we want to do well for our patients. We don't want to make mistakes. But we're in the front line. We're the one people having conversations with parents, and we don't want to say the wrong thing. We're dealing with the critically ill babies, some who are sicker or smaller than we ever possibly could have imagined before. We're prescribing medications we've never seen before and, you know, discussing outcomes that until last week we didn't know were possible. And that's another fact. We're dealing with the critically ill. Infancy remains the most likely time for a child to die. And for some of us here, being in the intensive care will be the first time that we'll see one of our patients die. And that's distressing. A few years ago, I responded to a Category 1 cesarean section for a term baby for a fetal bradycardia. Most of us have probably been to one of those. You know, the baby usually comes out squawking, we give it a little bit of a rub, pass it off to mum and give them a wave and a smile and a congratulations, and we're out of there within 5 minutes. But this baby was different. She wasn't breathing. She didn't have a heartbeat. And despite an extensive resuscitation that lasted for over 45 minutes with well-trained staff, she died. And the distress that I felt for the weeks after, you know, her passing was really significant. And I thought, why has this happened? She was a baby that looked fully formed, that was term. She was born in a tertiary unit with well-trained staff. She had a heartbeat just before knife to skin. But the fact is that sad, unimaginable things happen in the nursery. There will be times when things happen that we don't agree with. Things happen that, you know, we find distressing. Perhaps a baby being resuscitated at the edge of viability. And we need to sit with that distress, that, you know, that moral dilemma that we face. So not only are we dealing with critically ill babies, but we're also on a daily basis, you know, looking at ourselves and what our beliefs are when it comes to these little babies. So what are the barriers for us to speak up for ourselves and to advocate for ourselves when we're distressed and, you know, to advocate for families? Well, why do we find it so hard? Well, for families, it's a new environment to them. They don't know how to provide us with feedback. And the literature actually shows that they don't want to provide us with bad feedback either, because they fear retribution on their child. Imagine that, being not wanting to give your treating team bad feedback because you worry about what's going to happen to your baby when you leave that door. And I found that quite confronting when I was reading it, and I thought, surely not. Surely we're a trustworthy group of individuals. You know, we can build relationships with families. And then I thought about it a little more, and I thought, I've been that person. Even though that's a comfortable environment for me, I've been the person that hasn't stopped a staff member who went and touched my baby without washing their hands. I've sat there quietly when a team member's come in and being clearly sick, coughing and spluttering everywhere, and I haven't said anything. So if I can do that, imagine what it must be like for people that aren't as well educated, for families that don't speak English as their first language, for families that aren't sure if their baby is going to survive. So how can we move forward from this? How can we start using our voice more and advocating for ourselves and advocating for our families? How can we, when we turn up to a new workplace, ask, why is it done that way? And, you know, we get the response of, it's always been done that way. And how can we challenge that without sounding like a whiny junior registrar or being a demanding parent? Well, we can use our voice. So we can establish relationships with families. Say good morning. Introduce yourself. Use the mum and dad's name. Use the baby's name. Those simple techniques have been shown to improve the family connectiveness to the care team, to empower families and to help them advocate for their babies. Provide families with support. Consider whether every family needs psychosocial support, whether they need an interpreter. Be approachable and offer frequent family meetings. Provide education to the family. Try to get them to be involved with their baby. Reduce those physical barriers. Encourage them to come along and do daily cares, bath their baby, remove the SATS probe. Explain what that alarm actually means when it says 88. Rather than saying, don't worry about it, it's okay. Because I can tell you when that alarm goes off, your heartbeat goes up. And I knew what that alarm meant, and still, every time I heard that alarm attached to one of my babies, I was like, practice family-centered care. So there's been a lot of research recently in neonates about family-centered or integrative care. And it's been shown that it can reduce the length of time babies stay admitted in your unit. It can improve breastfeeding. And there are some practical aspects of it that, aren't possible in every unit. You see, there's a lot of units that we can't do single rooms in or provide accommodation for families to stay next to their babies. But there are a lot of aspects of family-centered care that we can undertake by simply using our voice and encouraging families. Invite them on the ward round. Ask their opinion about their baby. We must acknowledge that families will often sit by their baby's bedside for hours every day. They will develop an expertise about their baby. So value their opinion, value their concerns, and provide an opportunity for feedback for them. So what can we do for ourselves and our colleagues to improve our rotation? Well, providing opportunities for feedback is important for us too. When you're on ward rounds and deciding what type of ventilation to use or what type of antibiotics you're going to use, explain your thinking for that. Why has that occurred? Not only does it provide a good opportunity for teaching, but it also provides the opportunity to others to provide feedback for you. Provide protected teaching time and regular staff meetings, and validate your colleagues' concerns. A few years ago, actually, I was one of the first extremely prem deliveries I went to. One of my jobs there was to keep the wraps warm. So I had to keep them warm and open the knee wrap in a sterile manner and pass it off to the midwife in theatre. And I'd never done that before. I'd never even seen a wrap before. Like, what's this plastic thing? I was only new there. And I let the team know that, you know, I feel a little bit uncomfortable about this. And the director was standing there with me and he said, "Jasmine, don't worry. When I was a junior doctor, I wanted to keep the wraps really warm, so I held them really, really high, close to the heater, and they caught on fire. So if your wraps aren't on fire, you're doing a good job." So with that simple story, he validated my concerns. He said, you know, it's all right to feel that way. So that's really important to do. You know, you may not have those concerns anymore, but it's important that your junior staff and those around you may still be worried about things that you no longer are. Let's lead by example. If we're feeling distressed or uncomfortable about something that's occurring in the unit, be open with it. Express that. Ask for help from your colleagues. Ask for a mentor. Ask to debrief. Everybody, whether you're a junior, you know, a resident, an intern, or a consultant, will feel discomfort at some point in the neonatal unit. So remember, the next time that you're in the intensive care, it's really common to have some distress. It's really common to feel uncomfortable there. Parents find it challenging, doctors find it challenging, but if we use the simple strategies of openly communicating about that, asking for support and supporting our colleagues, we can improve that. We can change the culture that exists there, and we can work towards having more positive journeys for all of our people, no matter how small. Thank you.
We'll pass it over to Andy for some questions.
Thanks, Jazz. That was wonderful. So I've got a couple of questions from people in the audience. First from Joe Beattie. What was the biggest medical myth your experience as a NICU mum would dispel?
Ooh. Biggest medical myth. That's a really good question. You know, I think, like everybody, I really enjoyed your talk yesterday. And I think there's a lot of things as a medical mum. You know, it was really hard for me because I was sort of playing this dual role. When we were admitted there, I really tried to switch that part of my brain off and just enjoy the waves, ride the waves of those emotions of being a parent there and not having any control, which is really difficult for us as doctors. But I found that, the most challenging part and, you know, the myths associated with it was that, as you very well alluded to, a lot of the time in neonates we're just rolling on what's best-ish practice, not necessarily a lot of evidence-based practice. And when you're on the other side of that, that doesn't feel that comforting.
And I've got another question from some chap called Henry Goldstein.
Oh,
I don't know who he is.
That chap.
No conflict of interest to declare here.
No.
How can units better support parents away from the clinical space?
That's a great question as well. But I think you guys have done it so beautifully, and I know in a lot of different units I've worked in, there are support groups available to families with varying success. As family members of somebody that's been admitted, I think it's important to ask people what they need, you know, and as practitioners as well, you know, it's all well and good to go in there and say, okay, have you got any questions? Do you want to be on the ward round? But some families find that really confronting. So it's important to ask that family what their specific needs are. You know, they might not want to talk to social work. They might not want to sit down in the team room and have a cup of tea and talk to the other parents. I certainly found that really uncomfortable because often families then would ask me questions, and that kind of was a bit much for me at that time. So I think asking families what they need and going from there is important.
Are there any additional questions from the floor for Jazz? Wonderful. We will move along now to our next speaker.